You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 506. Whatever you do, be great at it. Shane Hurlbutt.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success.
The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Now, guys, today on the show, we have cinematographer and educator Shane Hurlbutt. Now, you might know Shane's work from movies like Semi-Pro with Will Ferrell, Swing Vote with Kevin Costner, the $200 million plus budget Terminator Salvation, We Are Marshall, Into the Blue, The Greatest Game Ever Played, and the list goes on and on. And Shane and I go deep into the weeds on what it takes to light a good scene with no budget, with a lot of budget, his experiences in the business, his journey from where he started to where he is today, how he has changed his point of view of how to run a set, how he runs his team. And we also talk about his amazing educational products for cinematographers, and so much more. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Shane Hurlbutt. I'd like to welcome to the show Shane Hurlbutt. How you doing, Shane?
Alex, how are you? I'm doing amazing. I'm doing freaking fantastic.
I feel that's the pandemic talking, sir.
No, not at all. I love to stay positive in every way, shape, and form. And one of the things that I was told by a mentor years ago is, like, everyone always comes in to work and they always ask you how you're doing. And I only have two words: freaking fantastic. Every single day. It sets the bar.
That's a great piece of advice. And it does set the day. Cause if you're the cinematographer, you walk on set and your crew's like, how are you doing? You're like, oh man, it's going to be a rough day. That's it. Just
exactly
kills the day.
But when you say, you know, because a lot of times I'll be walking in and the, you know, electric will come in and say, hey, Shane, how you doing? I go, I'm freaking fantastic. How are you? And they're like, whoa, this is going to be an amazing day. And it just never changes.
Right. It's a good piece of advice. As directors listening as well, how are you doing? Freaking fantastic. I love it.
Exactly. Yeah. Stay positive. Stay positive.
So Shane, your career has been varied, man. You've gone from indie stuff to all the way to $200 million plus projects. You've done it all pretty much, and that can be done with in cinematography. How did you get started, man?
Yeah, that was an interesting journey. I thought I was going to be a DJ.
I've never heard that before.
Oh yeah, it's a good one. So I was. I started doing the morning announcements at our high school. And everyone was like, wow, you got a really good voice. You should, you know, go for radio. And up in upstate New York, we had this radio station that had this incredible guy. I think it was like 94 Rock, you know, and it was a station that I listened to all the time. So I started to become a DJ. So I started doing dances and the prom and homecoming and all these different things. And went all over the local upstate New York area. And then when I decided to go to college, I was like, you know, I don't want to really burn my parents' money. They were kind enough to say they would help me with my education. So I was like, let me test the waters. Let me see if I like this. So I went to a small community college just to see if I really fell in love with radio. Well, the first year was radio, totally loved it. The second year was television, and the television just blew my mind. That's where it just started to open up these kind of ideas and creative inspiration and everything. And then a friend of mine was directing. He was in the USC directing program, and he came back to our hometown, and he was doing a small movie that summer. And I just wanted to be a part of it in any way I could. And I was a PA, and then I was a grip, and I was an electric, and I was doing everything I could. And at that point, I got in with a full ride scholarship to Emerson College in Boston, and I went there. And that was where I just fell in love with film. But the funny thing is I hated cinematography. I thought I was going to be a producer. Because I could convince anybody to do anything I wanted, and I was good with numbers.
fair enough,
right? I had that passion. I was positive. I was like, all right, you know, I could sell anything as well, you know. So I was like, all right. And you know, after about 3 months of me wearing my mom got me a nice 3-piece suit, and I was like pounding the pavement in Boston, knocking on doors, and every one of them was just slammed in my face saying, you know, no, no, no. I went back and I said, all right, let me go back to the internship that I had, which was at a local grip, electric, and camera house in Boston. And that's where I started. And I started to fall in love with grip and lighting and camera. And then I got to a point where within 3 months, I was running the whole rental division. And then I decided that I was starting to go out on jobs because I came from a farm, right? So that's my upbringing. We had like a 300-acre farm in upstate New York. And so I could drive 10-ton trucks, 40-footers, whatever it was, I could drive. Nice. So I started driving trucks, and I was the grip truck driver. And I started going out. I was managing the rental division and also going out on jobs. And quickly I saw that the only way I was going to move up in Boston is if the guy or the girl that was above me died. So I knew it was a very limited pool there. So I, you know, my fiance at the time, who was my high school sweetheart, Lydia, who I met at 3 years old, I said, Lydia, let's go to L.A. Let's, you know, make this mission, this exodus out of the East Coast and go to the West Coast. And that's what we did. And I started right back at the bottom again, working at a small little rental house. And then I got a job that they asked me to be the grip truck driver, which meant I had to leave my job at the rental house, which was, you know, I finally had a full-time job and I was starting to bring in some money. Ooh, $5 an hour. I'm in steel-toed boots and t-shirts and jeans working in the warehouse. But I finally said, okay, I'm going to go for it. So I got on this feature, and this feature was called Phantasm 2.
Nice. This
the ball is back.
Nice. Right?
And I worked as a grip truck driver, and I was averaging about 18-hour days. I was getting $350 a week. So it ended up being like, you know, 79 cents an hour or something like that when it was all said and done. So that was my break-in. And when I was, you know, I was because I knew the truck and organized and everything, I got a call on set. Terry Wimmer, the key grip, goes, Shane, run me in an 18 by 24 flag. So I ran in, grabbed the flag off the truck and ran it in. I was going down these steps into the crematorium set. And this Best Boy Electric, Brian Coyne, very good friend of mine, is an amazing director of photography and director as well. He's walking up the stairs and he goes, would you be scared? And I go, Brian, what the hell are you talking about? I got to run this flag down into Terry. He goes, would you be scared in the theater? Look, every nook and cranny is lit. There's no shadow. It was like, bam. From that point on, all I looked at was light. And I went from a grip truck driver in 1988 to shooting my first music video for Nirvana, Come As You Are, in 1991. So in 3 years, I aspired. It just, from that on, it was just off to the races.
That's awesome. What was it like shooting with Nirvana, man? I mean, that must have been insane.
Oh, my God. I did three. I did Come As You Are. I did In Bloom. And I did Lithium. And I did Stone Temple Pilots, Vaseline, Interstate Love Song. We did
all the 90s, all the great 90s bands.
All the grunge era. Yeah, I was really hot on the grunge era.
That's amazing. I have to ask you real quick, when you were coming up in the grip departments, did anyone ever just point over to a pile of cables that were about a mile long and said, detangle those for me?
Oh, yes.
So did I.
Absolutely. And there were a lot of crazy gigs I got myself into. Condor operation was the worst for me because, they put you up in that condor 80, 90 feet in the air.
Jesus.
And I'll never forget one day. It was one of those stories that you remember back in the history of like, oh my God, I could have died kind of moment. I was working on some really bad, D movie for deferred pay. That was a big thing when I was getting.
Did you get that? Did you get the deferred pay?
Never. I did like 20 of them, Alex. 20 of these all on deferred pay. Never got paid a dime. So I'm in this condor and the wind starts kicking up and it's got two 18Ks in it. And the gaffer says, we need to bring it down. So I'm like, I need to come down. This is way before all the, high tech wind devices and everything and all the beautiful safety things that we have now that this would have never happened. But I was freaking out because the basket was moving around like crazy up there. And he's like, you're not coming down. It's fine. And I said, okay, and all of a sudden this big wind gust came up and all of a sudden that condor just started to go.
No.
So the thing starts slowly going and it's starting to pick up steam and pick up steam and pick up steam. And I'm just looking and I'm like, okay, and it's over a ledge, right? It's over like this ravine.
No.
And that thing's just going to go right over it, right? So I'm thinking to myself, okay, that's going to crush everyone down below me and everything is coming down. So at about 20 feet, I disconnect my safety harness and I jump. So I land, and roll, just to the side of the ravine so I don't go off of it. And this lift literally comes down and parallels. And everyone, it was like, it was watching paint dry, even though it happened a lot faster, but it was like, and then it just hung there. And then all of a sudden it was like, and then it just started gathering steam, and everything. And then it just went whack like this. And the 18K shot out of the damn lift. And it was the coolest lighting effect I've ever seen in my life because the 18Ks went boom, and then everything went jet black.
Oh my God.
And then the gaffer came over to me and he started yelling at me like
yelling at you.
I almost killed myself and I was going to kill everyone else too, because this thing would have gone right over the ravine. It was going to take out the whole camera department. Oh my God.
And he yelled at you?
Yeah, he yelled at me. Yeah, that was, that's how, that's how it was done back then.
Oh my God. So you literally, I mean, if you would have been, it could have easily, instead of stopping, you could have kept going because of your weight.
Oh yeah. Would have kept on going because, you know, here was the, this, we were shooting on a road like this and the condor was out like this backlighting it.
Yeah, yeah,
kind
yeah.
of a hot top light. So I was going like this over the ravine with the 18K. So I jumped just to the side of the road and rolled down this thing. So it would have gone over, caught that nick, and then the whole condor would have gone over the edge.
Oh my God. But it's insane. What year was this? Was this the 90s?
Oh, this
no,
is
80s.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. That's the 80s were how we survived the 80s as a general statement is.
That's so right.
It's like kids today are like looking around like, oh, this hurts or that hurts. I'm like, are you kidding me? What we had, you are just look at our playgrounds.
Oh, I know.
In the 70s and 80s.
I know our playgrounds were literally torture chambers.
They were death traps.
Now they're like, you know, they got the foam, you know, and the rubber everywhere. So if you fall and you bounce and it's beautiful.
No, it was straight concrete. It was straight concrete. 5 stories up on the monkey bars, you would fall, crack your skull, or you would go to the top story of the slide that was metal and on your shorts in the middle of the summer and get third-degree burns. And your skin's peeling off because it's so damn hot. You're like, now it's all plastic and it's all like, oh, it's that's why. Yes, exactly. That's an amazing story. That's an amazing story. So, you've lit some very large sets and some very big action sequences. I'm thinking of Terminator. How do you approach lighting these massive set pieces? I mean, these sets are massive with, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of people running around, VFX you're thinking about, practicals. I mean, just as a cinematographer, how do you approach mentally to cover that and light it and then cover it?
Yeah. So, you know, the kind of big footprint, you know, lighting setups are something that I absolutely love. You know, it kind of, you think about it, I kind of take it apart like a, let's say a football field, right? If you can shoot 3 directions on it with the light. If I light it from this direction, then it's a side light to this way, it's a side light that way, and it's a backlit this way. Mm-hmm. So you got 3 areas that you can cover from creating one big light source, let's say. So let's take Terminator Salvation, for example, the processing plant that we did.
Oh, yeah.
Where, you know, all those people are being pushed by that bulldozer thing that, you know, I embedded these spikes in it and these lights that erupt and it starts pushing the people. And we kind of, you know, I wanted... Everything is all about the, you know, lighting the background first, then lighting the mid ground, then eventually the foreground where the actors might be playing. So my big thing for that was, okay, how can I create this incredibly, you know, really scary tone in this Terminator Salvation processing plant? So I was like, all right, what if I get some metal halide lights and get like 60 of them and line them up on basically creates stadium lights.
Mm-hmm.
So we created these massive 55-foot pettibones with, I think it was like 20 metal halides on each one. And they were like in racks of, you know, 5 across, 4 high. And we catapulted those up. And what I wanted to do, and you don't see it in the movie because they cut it out beforehand, but what these things did is they aimed straight up in the air and they were all full spot. And it almost looked like a tractor beam. And that was the whole idea, is through the fog and the dirt and all that stuff, this was the guiding light for, you know, the transporters to come in and mm-hmm. settle down into the area. It was like this tractor beam. And then I racked them straight up. And then as they came in and landed, these things started to tilt down and just, you know, expose the whole bed of several transporters that are dropping all these people off. So that was my first big approach for lighting something that was like 5 football fields long and a football field wide, is just the motivation of what the emotion is. Like, okay, these are the machines. Let's go metal halide. Let's turn it that blue-green kind of nastiness. Let's inject these white beaming lights that flare the lens and are foreboding and dangerous for people. And then do it in a way that, you know, I put a very subtle amount of fill, so it still had that dark, dark nature to it, but you could barely see into the shadows areas to see that emotion from their faces and stuff. So, you know, lighting the big venues is usually starting with just one big source. And where is that one big source coming from? Right. I could go to like Greatest Game, where I would take a huge grand ballroom at Copley, at like the Copley Place. And it mm-hmm. was up in Montreal. And we found this amazing, ornate, turn of the century ballroom. And it's like, The bones are there. There's beautiful, warm practicals and everything. But if it's just that and just the window light, it doesn't feel grand. So it's like you have to bring that out with, you know, I put a huge source on the right-hand side that was out of frame that was 12 by 12 you know, bleached muslins, and I pounded 18 Ks into them and then shaped it with siders and toppers to feel like more window light that we don't see. Like the ballroom goes on forever.
Right.
And again, that's also the thing of selling the illusion, right? So this, we still have a beautiful wide shot from the second story and we're pushing in ever so slightly, but wow, there's this light coming in. So the ballroom must be going on for even more, you know? So lighting also, these elements create the illusion of bigger locations than they actually are. So just by bringing in that kind of cold tone mixed with the warm practicals and the sconces that are on the wall, it was a very easy light in that location because it just basically was started with practicals and one huge source. I try to kiss it, keep it simple, stupid.
Right.
It's like the more you add lights, the more complicated everything gets. So I try to, you know, start with one big source and then slowly add on to that. And the background is something that is everything to me. So I light that first and create all the depth and dimension, whether it's bokeh, whether it's, you know, out of focus other highlights or whatever it is that plays with light and shadow back there to give it depth and dimension, that three-dimensional quality. And then I slowly move to the mid-ground and then to the foreground where the actors are moving. And I generally try to light an area, not marks. One thing that Harris Savitas taught me, and he was so spot on with this. He goes, Shane, light an area, not a mark, because you want the actors to feel that they can move in this area and that it feels not so perfect and a little like it's beauty raw, I would say. And that's where I'd say Ben Hoytman, you know, he's another amazing director of photography, and he lights exactly like that. It's imperfect, but it's still beautiful. You know, it has that rawness to it. And you do that by just lighting an area and not necessarily lighting marks. Because lighting marks, they're gonna nail their mark, and you can have the perfect wrap on the key light and the perfect backlight and nice fill and everything. But when you have to light a larger area for them to move in, the imperfections of the light actually add to authenticity and reality, and I feel it feels more organic.
There's a movie that when I speak to cinematographers of all status, from the early, you know, guys just trying to come up to established cinematographers like yourself, there's a movie, and there's many movies we can point to, but there's one movie that I personally love, but it is kind of like this holy grail of cinematography in many ways. There are many holy grails of cinematography, but this is one. Searching for Bobby Fischer is one of those, because, and I always ask, I'm like, it's a family film. It's like, it's not grand. It's not flashy. But when I talk to cinematographers about that film, it was Conrad, right? It was Conrad Hall?
Yeah, Conrad Hall. Yep.
Yeah. He was doing things that no one had done before. He was using mirrors. Do you know what he did and how he lit that?
Yeah. I worked with Conrad Hall a little bit for a very short stint, as like a gaffer kind of slash, grip scenario. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I was amazed with is he's a hard light lighter. That's what he does. Hard light is his best, that's his toolbox. Mm-hmm. And what he does is every light on set is full spot.
Really?
There's no full flood. So if he's trying to cast shadows, yes, of course, he's going to full flood it so he can get the hard shadows. But when he's lighting a face, that light is full spot, and then it's scrimmed down to exactly the right level. So we were constantly like, I was like, when I'd walk on set, I was like, what is with all these double and triple scrim bags on these damn lights? I mean, who the hell needs that many scrims, you know? And then all of a sudden he's like, you know, spotting the thing in, and I'm like, damn, that's bright. And all of a sudden the full house became the thing. Two doubles and a single, boom, you know, full house it. Okay, another full house. And I'm like, how the hell does that even fit in there? And they're, you know, grip clipping the things on the outside, you know,
right.
to take it down. But that was how he lit. And Searching for Bobby Fischer used tons of that hard shadow and hard light to really show the emotions of them and all the characters. And, you know, another great one is Road to Perdition.
Oh,
you know,
God,
where
so
that's
gorgeous.
All lit. Hard light, and you know, the way he positions them, and the, you know, once working with him, my moonlight is always silver. It's like he really dialed in the silver moonlight. There was nobody that did silver moonlight like him, and that's something that I responded to, and I've always done. My silver moonlight is where it's at. And you know, another person that does that very well is Bob Richardson.
Oh,
like yeah. Snow Falling on Cedars is probably within the top five greatest cinematic achievements ever.
Wow.
I don't know if you've ever seen
it. No, I haven't. Movie. I haven't seen that one.
Snow Falling on Cedars is an absolute masterpiece.
Wow.
And you know, it's people always say, Shane, what is this with your style of only lighting from one side? I'm like, guys, just look at Snow Falling on Cedars. It's got it. And, you know, it's like, because what I love is that just that timeless light from one side. The fill never crosses over to this side. Everything is lit from one side or the other. And then you use the background to separate the dark side. And that's
and you don't fill
that
and you don't fill, or you do a little fill?
I fill from over camera. I never fill from the opposite side.
Really?
Everything is 180 degrees. Yeah.
Interesting. So you don't do standard 3-point lighting as they've taught in school. It's different.
No, it's 3-point lighting all from one side.
Interesting. That's a really.
So the backlight is on the same side as the key light.
Right.
The same side of the fill light. So everything is coming. So the backlight is not a dead back. It's a 3/4 back.
Right.
And then you add the softness of a key or a hard light of a key. So that's like a key on key scenario, as I call it, because you're keying with the backlight as well as wrapping the fill. And then what I'll do is I'll do this kind of a J shape that goes from hard to semi-hard to soft to super soft.
Mm-hmm.
All the way around. And that's kind of, you know, if I'm doing any kind of scenario where people are walking into frame or I'm lighting an area, that's kind of how I attack it. It's like, you know, it starts hard and then it moves around to like, you know, just a cream source with magic cloth.
Nice. Nice. That's a very, very interesting way of going about it. Now, there's we get caught up so much with cameras, or cinematographers and filmmakers get caught up with, like, what's the latest K? What's the latest this? What's how many? I need 45K. Really? Do you need 45K? Do you really need? Are you shooting IMAX? Really? For $500 for $50,000 independent feature, you need the 45K.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So what is your, the one thing I always tell filmmakers when they're like, what should I invest in? And I go, glass. If you're going to invest, it's always glass. Glass doesn't go, unless you're shooting 45K, then you might need to figure out a glass that's big enough to cover the sensor. But,
exactly.
But what glass do you, are drawn to for your projects? Is it a per project basis, or is there a specific, kind of glass that you really like? Cause I know cinematographers and their glass is they're very specific about what they really love.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it is based on per project because I feel that the glass is the soul of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
The camera is the tool, you know, it's kind of the, let's say it's the foundation of, you know, and the foundation, and let's say it's the mortar,
mm-hmm.
but the bricks, the soul of the building is the glass. And, you know, I've gone like every project, like let's say greatest game ever played, right? Mm-hmm. I, you know, working with Bill Paxton, you know, we stumbled onto a look of this book called Bound for Glory, which was all these reclaimed, they found them in some person's attic in Kansas City, Missouri, that were all these old Kodachrome prints from the FSA area, mm-hmm. era. And because the FSA had shot black and white throughout the whole time, but when Kodak came out with Kodachrome in the late 1930s, they 1600 prints were struck. And these were printed in this book, Bound for Glory. And both Bill and I really resonated that this is going to be the look for the greatest game. We wanted it to feel period, but we also wanted it to have a contemporary style to camera. So it's like we delivered a period look, but the camera, we flew with the camera, you know, with the ball and went into the hole. And we, you know, showed the power of each individual golfer, got inside their head. And so I did a lot of research on, you know, old glass. And I went to Panavision and I just dug into their archives for about 3 days. And I came out with these old Zeiss Ultra Speeds Mark IIs. They were like made in the late 60s. And their coating was not the greatest.
Mm-hmm.
And when you put them down to a T2, they started to really fall. .913. There was even a lens that was specifically done for Stanley Kubrick, and that was a 50 mil at a T1.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I always had that one in my arsenal. I grabbed that one. Mm-hmm. I had the 55. We called it the jacked up 50 or the double nickel. They were all these weird focal lengths, a 20, a 29.
A 29? Wow.
Yeah, 29, which is the greatest Steadicam lens on the planet, the 29. Mm-hmm. It had, you know, like the double nickel, the 55. It had 16. You know, it had just all these very weird focal lengths. And we did a series of tests, and it took me 20 different sets to find a matching 3 set,
right?
Either yellow or just all jacked up. And they were, you know, everyone was like, why are you shooting with these things, Shane? These things were $15 a day to rent. That's it. $15 a day.
Wow.
And then once they were like, Panavision kept on saying, wow, Shane's really, you know, when I did Semi-Pro, I used that same glass.
Yeah.
When I did We Are Marshall, I used that same glass because it has a great period look. And they're like, what is going on with Shane? Why is he always shooting with these things? We got to investigate these. So then they took them and turned them into the classics now. So I think they call them the vintage primes. Mm-hmm. So all the Mark IIs were rehoused, because the one thing shooting with them, which is difficult, some lenses had this, some lenses had that, some lenses had this. You know, they were all over the map. So it created all these donuts and all this stuff.
Yeah.
It really slows the filmmaking process down every time you change a lens, right? So they P-vintaged these, put a new coating on them, and then rehoused them so they were all the same millimeter diameter. And, you know, now they go for $150 a day. but it was the same glass I use for $15 a day. And you can still get the Mark IIs that are not P vintage. And I go to those a lot as well. I'm always constantly, you know, bringing my set that I had resurrected. I'm like, can you find the serial numbers from back in the day of yore? And they're like, yes, we have them in your system. Here they are. And those are the lenses I end up shooting with. So I love the old vintage glass. I'm not the big anamorphic guy. I know anamorphic is a massive craze right now. Everyone's all into this thing. I couldn't be further from that. I like spherical. Spherical feels more real. Spherical feels more intimate. And when you get those wide angles pushed in close and really into the scene, which you cannot do with anamorphics because they cannot focus, you don't feel intimate with the actors. I always feel anamorphic lenses, you're a pedestrian. Why would you want that? Now, of course, there's tons of movies that don't feel like pedestrian that have been shot on anamorphics that are awesome. This is just my point of view. This is how I look at lenses and how I feel, because I'm much more of a person that not a long lensier, stand back and lens in. I like to be much more immersive. That really started with all the sports movies I started to do, because I felt, you know, getting inside the action and inside the game was much more powerful than showing the audience what they've already seen on television.
Right.
From the outside. Now, what you have to do is a beautiful balance of lensing from the outside to show geography and getting into the game. You can't just do in the game, because then nobody knows where the hell you are on the field.
Right.
So you do need those outside in shots. And that's something where I call it the inside out, right? It's like I try to first take apart the scene from doing it all inside the game. So you feel completely intimate. And then you say, what do you need to tell the story geography? And that's what you use from the outside. So it's not like, okay, let's establish it. You know, it's not outside in, it's inside out.
Now, have you ever shot with a Canoptic?
Oh my God. Yeah, I got that camera. They sent that thing to me.
No, not the camera, the lens, the Canoptic.
I thought you were talking about that weird Chinese.
No, not that one. No, I love vintage lenses, so I'm a vintage hound for lenses. The Canoptic 9.2, which is what Kubrick shot, shining inside the maze, shining, following the boy, and then in Clockwork Orange, if you the panning right before the they break in, they pan right from that. That's all. It's a 9.2 without fisheye. So then I got the 16 version of that. Sorry guys, we're gonna geek out for a second. I got the 16 millimeter version of that, which is a 5.7, and connected it to the Blackmagic Pocket 1080p, and it's stunning. I shot my last feature with it. It's stunning.
Oh, wow.
It's just no fisheye, but you need light. Yeah. It's great for outside. Inside, you got to pump some light into it. But I always tell DPs about that, and they're like, "You mean no fisheye? Like it's such an old lens that I call it the Kubrick, because Stanley loved shooting with that. Have you ever shot with it?
No, I haven't. I got to check that thing out. I mean, I do it's love old. The Kawas. You know,
yeah,
I've always
those
been
are
a
nice
fan of the Kawas. I really like those. I like the old, you know, a lot of the Zeiss that they took like the coatings off.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Those are nice.
And all those guys have, you know, done a lot of re-engineering on a lot of the older glass. But I do, like I said, it's project by project. But one thing that I've been doing a lot lately is using Leica. And I've always been a fan of Leica.
It's a gorgeous.
If you look at all the Panavision glass, Panavision were lights glass. It was not Panavision glass. It was lights glass. So, and that's what I really responded to coming up in my career. I was all about the Panavision Primo Prime. So when the new Summicrons and Summiluxes came out with the Leicas, I did tests on both. And I found that, you know, the Summiluxes with the 1.3 give you an amazing, you know, shallow depth of field and much more of a flatter feel. They're very clinical.
Mm-hmm.
But the Summicrons at a T2 and basically $10,000 less a lens, they have more of the imperfections and they're better with skin.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't flatten out a face. The face has dimension. So those have been like my secret weapon for a lot of the work that I've been doing lately. Is I just love the Summicrons. And I don't need a 1.3. I love my T2, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but then you go for like Need for Speed. I shot with Cook S4s. I love that. Fathers and Daughters, Cook S4s. Terminator, I shot with Panavision Primos. I love the way they flared. I love
the flares were nice in that
contrast. Mm-hmm. Also the contrast of those lenses. They have a real good contrast ratio. So yeah, it's really per project for sure. And I think, you know, I was interviewing for a project recently, and I was like, there were kind of two different worlds, and I was looking at a lot of tests with the Ingenues, mm-hmm. those new Premier Primes that came out. And that glass has a slight magenta to it. It's got a slight softness in the center, and it creams out beautifully. So I was going to use that for this area of the movie. And then the more kind of, you know, raw and gritty, I was actually going to do like the Zeiss signature primes that have much more of a bold, contrasty look. So just using glass to tell the story and not necessarily your color correction bag.
I wanted to ask you, I always love asking DPs this, what was the best time you've ever had on set? Like the most fun that you're like, everything was clicking, either just something that happened fun on the set or the lighting was just like, I nailed it.
Oh, let's see. There's been a lot of those moments. One I think that really comes to mind, and it has a soft part in my heart, was when I was doing We Are Marshall.
Oh,
we were shooting and in Huntington, West Virginia for the first 3 weeks of the movie. And so we were all at those locations where it all went down. Mm-hmm. We went to the airfield where the plane crashed. We went to the university and took all that flavor in. And there was a scene that we did out in the middle of nowhere on this lone road where Matthew Fox, who is Red, who did not hop on the plane,
mm-hmm.
he drove. And it was my dad had come down with pancreatitis.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never had to leave a movie. And I had to, they told me he was going to die. So I went to Mick G and I said, Mick G, I need a week off. I got to go see my dad. He's on his deathbed. So I flew back to Syracuse, New York, and stayed with my dad for a week. And he actually turned around. And when I flew back, the first shot I did was this lone road with the isolated gas station in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember coming up and I'm like, you know, all right, let's encircle that thing with yellow fluorescence around the exterior. Let's put a metal halide back behind to glow those trees. And let's put one lone you know, two 24 light Dinos on a 120 foot Condor and just bring moonlight down the street, wet it down so it has that glisten. And I just put the camera didn't even have to move. It was just like, bam. And we see that lone car with the headlights and he pulls over in the gas station. And it was like, this is one of those iconic moments where, my God, I thought my dad was going to die. Mm-hmm. I, you know, stumble on set, basically got off the plane, right, you know, in night exterior. So I had to turn myself around into nights. And, you know, this was the first frame that came out of me after all that emotion that I had gone through. And that was like a very defining moment. And then recently I worked on this movie that was like a teen rom-com. And it was with a director, Emily Ting. And it was, she was from Hong Kong, and she had an amazing pitch deck on the movie, and her vision was very strong. And we just completely bonded, shot listing and coming up with this thing. And the last 3 days of the film were our big dance numbers, because they did the musical Bye Bye Birdie. And I and Emily and the production designer did not want to do it like most high school musicals would have done it, very literally. We wanted to take a very kind of surreal take on this and very abstract in the lighting. And then working with the dance team and the choreography to be able to put all these lights in and how they positioned and moved with the dancers. And I'm just telling you, I was at that monitor, and when the shit all came together, it was absolute magic. And it was like one of those kind of moments where you just look back and you say, my God, I love when, you know, it's all the departments just all, you know, fueling on 12 cylinders. It's like you got production design just knocking out the sets and the abstract nature of it. You got my lighting team that is just bringing the excellence and precision. You got the dancers delivering every single time, no matter how many times I said, okay, we got to do it again. And it's like the 80th time. And they were like saying, you know, Shane, we see so much of your passion and what you're in. When you told us we had to do it for the 81st time, we were all in, even though we were spent, you know. And it's like that kind of positive nature and seeing it all happen on screen, and then the wave of accolades from the choreographer to the dancers to everyone saying that they just felt like, you know, this small little unit was making everything so special, and we cared so much that they were represented so beautifully. And I don't know, it's just that one of those awesome kind of moments where you kind of just, you sit back and you say, God, I love what I do. I absolutely love what I do.
That's awesome. Now, do you have any business advice that you wish you would have heard at the beginning of your cinematography career?
Yeah. the biggest advice I can give to people is that it takes time to be a filmmaker.
Right.
It's not something that you can just pick up a camera and start making movies. Experience cannot be overlooked, and it cannot be so shortcut. It's not a shortcut. You have to go through the process of failure and succeed and failure. I mean, I failed so much when I was first starting out. My God, I'll never forget my first gaffing gig. I was doing a Barbie commercial, and we had started outside day exteriors. So I had set my meter at 50 ASA, and I was out there exposing film and all great. And then we came into the soundstage. Well, I forgot to we're lighting this thing, the whole thing. And then I went up to the DP and I said, I just want to tell you, I've been rating this at 50 ASA. And he freaked out. You know, that was 2.5 stops overexposed. Mm-hmm. He was worried with the Barbie and the client.
Didn't shot, but they shot at that ASA? Like they shot, this is pre-shooting or after you lit it and they shot?
We were shooting this whole time. And then I realized after lunch that I had set my meter wrong. So everything that we had shot up to lunch was basically burnt. 2.5 stops overexposed. So, you know, we had to go back to the agency and the creatives, and that put him in a very difficult place. And, you know, these are things that, you know, these are big mistakes, but you got to learn from them. And this is what I talk about with the experience. You got to put yourself out there and you got to know you're going to fail. And I just, that's my whole mantra, is like, I just want to continue to challenge myself, push myself out of my comfort zone. You know, there's, even as in my career right now, I make mistakes, you know, I try new things and I'm like, God, what was I thinking with this? You know, that didn't work. But you know, you pick yourself up, you cinch those suspenders and you and so my biggest advice to anyone starting out in this industry is you want to start at a rental house, bar none. If you want to be a director of photography, you got to get your hands on the camera. You got to listen to the people that are coming in. You got to listen to what they're using. You got to take all that in. That's experience that you're building that's happening just organically. Right. It's like all you have to do is get that camera out there and you just listen while you're doing stuff. Why are they using this type of filter? Or why are they setting the camera up this way? I'm going to mental note on that. And the same with a grip and electric house. You know, I started out in a rental house. So on Terminator Salvation and the big mine escape, you know, where they go through the landmine and it's all one shot, you know, beautifully choreographed where we're going with them and all that stuff. We had a Xenon, 4K Xenon on a scaffolding tower as our quote unquote searchlight. Right when we were about ready to go, the light goes out. Well, everyone's scrambling and they don't know what's happening and all that stuff. And I had this duster jacket. They called me the Crow. And I run across and the thing flipped in the wind, you know, and I run to the Xenon and I pop out the side panel and the fuse is blown. And I take it, I grab some aluminum foil, I wrap it around the damn thing, jam it in there, hit the transformer and boom, the light ignites. And I run back and they're like, holy shit, how did you know how to do that? And I'm like, well, these were workarounds in the rental house when, you know, we wanted to see if the light fired and we didn't have the fuse. And these fuses were a specific one that necessarily we didn't carry all the time. And this was the workaround. So it's like I'm constantly at even to this day where, you know, there's so many new people coming up the ladder and with this tax incentive states and Atlanta just exploding and there's not enough crew there to really support the movies. So a lot of people are just walking off, you know, farming community and construction sites and all of a sudden, you know, right to work, they're gripping electrics. So I'm constantly trying to, you know, teach this, you know, this new age of people that were quote unquote did not go to film school. They just are doing it for the money. That's that new regime that I'm seeing within the industry. That's been a big shift that I started feeling in 2018 when I went up to Canada and all of my electrics were on permits. And they had all been on oil dikes just a month earlier.
So, and they had never been, and they'd never been on set before?
No, no.
How do you hire someone who's never been on set before to work and grip an electric? How does that work? You have to. I mean, there's so much you have to learn.
Yeah. No, no kidding. Yeah.
Like what's a flag? What's a C stand? I mean, like basic stuff.
Yes.
And and that was the crew that was given to you and you're just like, I got to roll with this and I got to teach everybody. And did you just send them to your academy online?
Basically, yes. I started after that moment in 2017, 2018, I created a grip and electric platform. So it teaches them how to use C-stands, how to set flags, what they are, what they're called, how to run power, how to plug it in, how to distribute power, all that stuff. I just started doing grip and electric because I'm like, I come up and the first thing I do is I gift it to every grip and electric that's on my crew. And the people that are experienced, they're like, ah, I got this. Or the people that aren't, they take it. And at least they have some kind of infrastructure and awareness to like what things are called and how to use stuff.
So is that, you're a seasoned cinematographer. So some of these projects, obviously you can't fly everybody in from LA. So you have to deal with locals.
Yes.
And that's the locals they have because there just literally is no other crew in the area that could handle when they're busy on other projects or something.
Yeah, correct. When I did Resident Alien in the fall of 2018, there were 78 series and films in Vancouver.
Yeah, they're gone.
Right. So everyone was gone, you know.
So you roll with whatever you had to roll with at the time. Yeah.
And, you know, this is the new norm I see because, you know, there's so much production going on and it just literally, you know, and most of these places might have 8 to 10 teams deep. Might. Right. So that's 8 features. And then if you have rigging teams, then you're taking out a whole other plethora of technicians. So yeah, it's been sometimes you get just amazing talent. And then there's sometimes that you don't, and you try your best to work with it. But I've kind of, you know, set a positive spin on it because I do love teaching as well. And so I try to set it up so they're learning as much as they can. And I take the time when I can to kind of educate them and get them up to speed.
It seems like a pretty big load to carry as a cinematographer on a project live, to be like shooting and also educating your crew at the same time. I mean, from my experience on set, that's a pretty difficult thing to do. So God bless you, sir.
It is. And it's so funny because all the ADs always give me a ton of shit. You know, they're like, all right, we're having a Hurlbut Academy moment, you know?
Right, because...
All right, now this is how and I'll go into it, and he goes... And then he goes, all right, hold on, crew. We're having a Hurlbut Academy moment right here while I'm teaching the guy. And I'm like, dude, don't expose me, for Christ's sake.
I mean, it's a... For people who haven't been on set, it can be a rough place to be sometimes, especially when you got those older, gnarly, you know, gaffer grips, first ADs, production designers, like heads. They can definitely rub you. No question. Do you have any low budget lighting tips for independent filmmakers because there's so many features being made at micro budgets of 50, 100, 150 or lower, to get a decent image, you know, because the cameras are really sensitive. I mean, you could get a lot out of some of these low budget cameras.
Oh, absolutely. I think that, you know, like the Venice and the Red Gemini, let's say, has really opened up, and the Panasonic Varicam at the 5000 ASA, this kind of dual ASA scenario that the Venice as well as the Gemini and the Panasonic have, the super sensitivity, you know, I would say, you know, practicals are your best friends. And what I did with the Canon C500 on Need for Speed Fathers and Daughters is I would literally take that camera and plop it down. I call them shit sticks, right? So they're like, you know, those little carbon fiber kind of plasticky sticks, and I slap the camera on it, and I would not light the room until that camera was up and turned on, because the Gemini, that Canon, the Venice, and the Panasonic, they see light that and add contrast that your eyes don't.
Right. It's gone beyond the eye now.
Yeah. So that you can say, wow, that practical is doing really well. I don't have to simulate that, or this is looking really good here. And then I will roll my color temperature wheel and find that what's looking really good in the set. Mm-hmm. And then I start to light. And, you know, from a DIY standpoint, you know, having practicals around that you can position and kind of help light the rooms and stuff is one thing. The other thing is just embracing, you know, Home Depot and Lowe's. I love clamp lights. I still use them all the time. I'm using clamp lights all the time. I'm putting, you know, those under cabinet lights.
They're gorgeous. From, yeah.
You know, from Home Depot, I'm using the LED strips, to stick underneath things. You know, I tend to, I like the old Dusk to Dawn fixtures, the metal halide and sodium vapor. So I'll buy a couple of those and I can illuminate those, cause they match street lights perfectly. So you don't have to worry about gel. You don't have to worry about all those things. Obviously the sky panels will match that, you know, source.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
But if you don't have the money, you know, you can pick up a Dusk to Dawn for under $60 and 400 water puts out a lot of light. And, you know, you look at Swing Vote and Crazy Beautiful and, you know, those films I lit all with those sodium vapor lights that it were all from Home Depot. And, you know, just going in and using fluorescents for when you want to use them. I'd get shop fluorescents and cool white bulbs. And that's what I'd hang in the ceiling for over the kitchen area because, you know, they lived in a trailer and trailers always had that kind of, you know, weird recessed panel that was there with the fluorescent lights up into it. So, you know, let's be real. Let's deliver the light that's reality, you know? So I just screwed some shop fluorescents to the ceiling and put them up, you know? So there's a whole plethora of DIY tips, you know, with the clamp lights, with those fluorescents, with the new LED sticks and strips and LED ribbon.
China balls. Don't forget China balls. China balls are always.
China balls. Yeah. Always using China balls. And then I shape them with, you know, black tablecloth. You know, plastic tablecloth works beautifully. You don't have to use Duvetine. You can use black tablecloth because black tablecloth doesn't have the sheen of Visqueen. Mm-hmm. It's matte. So it's very much like Duvetine, just not fire retardant and obviously thick and heavy. Mm-hmm. So the black tablecloth works beautifully to shape lights in different locations and ceilings where you can't, you know, be rigging these big toppers and everything because you can't compromise the location. Some good frog's tape and black tablecloth and you're off to the races, you know.
Great, great, great tips. Which brings me to your online academy. Please tell me about your labor of love that is the Hurlbut Academy.
Yeah. So, yeah, this is something that in 2009, when I was shooting Act of Valor, we literally flew around the world twice on that movie. We were down in Puerto Rico where we were shooting the bad guys kind of, you know, lair. In Puerto Rico. And we stayed at this amazing hotel that was on the west side of the island. And my wife came down to be with me for a week. And we were sitting in bed one night and I was planning out my shot list for the next day. And she goes, you know, Shane, what you're doing with this DSLR platform and how you have kind of spearheaded this revolution. We need to talk about this. We need to share your knowledge and really ignite a revolution. And I was like, what the hell are you talking about?
I'm just shooting. She goes,
I'm a cinematographer. And she goes, I'm going to brand you. Right. And I'm like, I'm a cinematographer, not a brand. And sure enough, with her vision and forward future thinking ways, she, you know, said, let's start this blog and let's share knowledge. And I was like, okay, sounds great. So we started this little blog and the blog just exploded during the DSLR revolution because I was doing things that everyone was like, what? You know, you're shooting a major feature film that's going to go in 9,000 theater screens on a DSLR still camera. Right. And I'm like, yeah. And this is the settings that make your camera cinematic. And this is what ISO you want to shoot at to have the lower noise. And this is the lenses that you want to fabricate to, you know, so it just like exploded. And based on that, they wanted more. and more and ask for more and give, you know, let's start your writing. It's writing's great, but we want video content. So then in 2014, we launched Shane's Inner Circle. Yeah. And that was our first stab at a membership platform. And we really didn't know what the heck we were doing. All I knew is I had passion and I had this God-given talent to really inspire people and teach. And I just wanted to throw gasoline on anyone who wanted to be a part of it, to just, you know, fuel that flame. And so we started out and we said it was going to be like the Netflix for filmmakers. You know, we made it super cheap because I didn't want all the weight of the world on me to produce all this content. If it was really expensive, then the weight of the world was going to be on me and I wasn't going to be able to be a cinematographer. So we started out with just little longer blog posts and more depth and going down rabbit holes. And then we just started video content. And when the video content hit and we saw how people responded to it, it was like, all right, let's start to structure where I can be a cinematographer and then do my movie and then come back and start shooting and creating this content. And we just started to do it at the grandest scale. We started 40 footers, 50 man and women crew, you know, full on catering and production and all the stuff to be able to put this together. And it blossomed into what the Hurlbut Academy is right now, which is, you know, basically our tagline now, which is going to be the Filmmakers Academy very soon, is master your craft. And we basically, with this platform, we're bringing all my friends and all my loyal, you know, vendors and everyone that have helped shape me as a cinematographer. I'm now inspiring them and finding the ones that really want to teach and give back. And now we're going to get this team of A-listers together and we're just going to really come out swinging. And, you know, the Filmmakers Academy is going to be all about that top level that you aspire to, right? It's like as much as I love the DIY tips and kind of the popsicle sticks and gaffer's tape stuff, you know, if I teach at that level, where do they have to aspire to? You need to teach at the highest level, and it's their learning and their experience that's going to scale it. Because if I do it at their level, then I've already filled in the blanks and I've already done their job for them. Mm-hmm. What I want them to do is exactly what I did when I was a cinematographer coming up the ladder. I looked at Roger Deakins and Bob Richardson and Emmanuel Lubezki, and I was like looking at the style of light and how they softened it and everything. And that was my mantra. Even when I was doing like the low budget music videos and little commercials and all the stuff where I didn't have the big 18Ks and everything that they had, I just, in my mind, I had to scale it. And that shaped me as a cinematographer. So I'm like, this is how we educate. We educate at the highest level, but we do it in a way that's very fun. It's kind of, you know, what do we call it?
Edutainment.
Edutainment. You know, yeah. It's like, I like to have fun. I give people shit on the crew. I'm always like, what are you doing? You know, oh, nice job. You cut that one short. All right, get another one. You're fired. You know, it's like we keep the set really light and airy and you see every single stroke. And because I came up on the technical side and did everything, light, grip, and camera, I'm setting every flag. I'm, you know, panning every light, spotting every light in, diffusing every light, setting the lens, doing all this so you see every finesse. And that's when it all started to happen for me as an educator, as I saw, oh my God, when we shoot this like a live sporting event, and there's like six or seven cameras, you see, you feel like you're on my shoulder and you're immersive. And that's the way I make my movies, is being right with you and very immersive. And the camera moves and flows with you. So I wanted the same thing with our education. And that's when we really started to to kick ass and to take off.
Well, I'll definitely put a link to the show notes for that. I have a few questions to ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Break in the business, start at a rental house. Know that it's going to take some time for you to get your experience. Do not get frustrated. Okay. You know, there's going to be times where things don't work out and you seem like you're working way too hard. And, you know, I gave a Hurlbutt Academy member, because the first 100 people that signed up for All Access, I gave them an hour long phone call.
Nice.
And this guy called me from Australia, and, he had heard my advice way on the blog talking about going to a rental house. So he was at a rental house. And I said, okay, so how long have you been at the rental house? And he says, 5 years. And I said, you've been there 4 years too long. And he goes, what are you talking about? I said, the rental house is your brick and mortar. That's where you're starting to figure it out. But you need to get on set now. You've already gone past your sell-by date. So I'm going to tell you how to get off and how to get out on sets. So I said, all right, so what do you do there? He goes, well, I'm the lead prep tech. All right. Okay, perfect. So you being the lead prep tech, you want to go into the marketing guy and you say who's coming in. And obviously you'll see the list and who it is. And you call up that first AC and you say, hey, Alex, how you doing today? I am, you know, John Doe. I am your lead prep tech at this rental house. And I was just wondering, you know, could we go get carts for you? Is there any place that you're storing your carts and I can have the truck come and get your carts? And are you a coffee drinker? Do you like coffee? And what do you like for breakfast in the morning? And he brought that stuff in. He started to do all those calls. And then I said, and also take note of what you see them do. So if they are labeling the cases, then you label them the cases before they get there. Label them with the millimeters, the close focus, and the T-stop of every one of them. You know they do that. You know they're going to do Velcro filter tabs. You know what their filter is. Start making those in your home. And he was like, boy, that's a lot of work. I said, this is what you need to do to set yourself apart from all the other people that are trying to do what you want to do, right? And literally, this advice I gave him, and he was out of the rental house in less than a month. And he's been working in the field ever since.
Good for
him. These are the small little nuances. And it's not brown nosy at all.
No.
It's just preparing yourself to this is exactly what you're going to do on the set. When you're a digital utility, what are you doing? You're getting the guy coffee, you're getting the guy lunch, you know, you're doing everything to set them up. You're coming in early, getting the carts off the truck, getting it all organized. This is, you're showing him or her that you are already in that mindset, that you know exactly what is going to be demanded of you. And you're not going to be the quote unquote, just rental house prep tech. And these are the things that set you above. It's the same way I did when I got out of the grip and electric. I was just like a guy who stacked, you know, grip shelves and trucks. The only reason that I got hired on Phantasm 2 is because the guy, the producer, was making the deal with the rental manager, and they happened to look out the window and they saw me running back and forth from the grip truck to the warehouse and back. And the guy goes, who's that guy? And they go, that's that guy from Boston that just came in. His name's Shane. He is a scrapper, man. We offered him $5 an hour and he took it, and he just runs circles around everyone. Huh, where was I? I was out of that place immediately. It's like, you have to do more than is required.
Amen.
And when you do that, you set a tone. Just like what we're going to circle right back and bookmark this son of a bitch and bookend it right here. Because what did I say in the beginning? There's only two words that come out of my mouth. Frickin' fantastic. And it's like, you set the bar high and you always do more than is required.
What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
to be a good leader.
Mm-hmm.
That took me a long time. When I was a kid, I was bullied like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
They did horrible things to me as a kid, and it was so weird because my dad was bullied by the same individuals that their dads' mm-hmm. kids.
Oh, Jesus. It's like right a movie. It's like a movie, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
Jesus.
It was crazy. Oh, it's like the Nolans bullied my dad, and then their kids bullied me. It was insane. So when I came up the ladder, I had a chip on my shoulder. I was somebody that just, you know, I was going to get to the top and I was going to take out some people on the way. Mm-hmm. And I was angry at times. I think I was, you know, somewhat, talked down to people. I didn't, it was my way or the highway. And, you know, it took me a long time to realize that, that I need to lead much better. And, that was, it's like I said, it took me probably 15 years to learn that. And, that was way too long. Right. And, now I have, crews that will, go to the end of the earth for me because I set the tone in a way that they are all part of the mission and no one is talked down to, and we are all in this together. And I try to wear my heart much more out on my sleeve,
mm-hmm.
Because I had to bury it so far down when I was bullied. I was just tortured so much that I just buried that heart. I buried that compassion. I buried all that.
Right.
And now I finally have come out of my proverbial shell, mm-hmm. and have really, through the education, and this is a testament to my wife, because I think really in 2009 and 2010, the 12, that was the linchpin to really start to be a better leader. And trust me, I've failed even along that process. In 2018, I failed on a movie. And I just want to be very transparent. These are things that you go through as a creative. You know, mm-hmm. there's a lot of pressure on you. There's a lot of, you know, things that are brought to the forefront, and you need to understand how to unite that team and take care of that team and listen to that team, as well as listening to production and having their best interests at heart, and then listening to the director. I call it the 33.3.
Mm-hmm.
Because before, it was 100% whatever the director wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I was not a good leader, because no matter what the director said, I just made it happen, even if I had to push it through a dime-sized hole.
Mm-hmm.
That thing was pushed. And now I look back at my career and I was like, you know what? Now I see that it's 33% is the director's vision and 33% is the production, is taking care of them and their budget and making things work, and not just, you know, say, this is what the director wanted. This is what the director wanted. This is what the director wanted. More like, okay, how can we reach a compromise that works for production and the director feels very good about, and it's supporting your team and being there for them and thinking about the safety.
Right.
And especially in these COVID times, big scare down in Atlanta just recently where they just kept on getting, you know, 4 positive COVIDs every other day and us just shutting down. I'm like, guys, the protocols aren't working. Everything that you've put in practice is not working. The people that we've hired obviously are not understanding it either, because you don't go out to block parties with thousands of people and then go in and start working on the lead actors, right? This is not the way you move and push forward in this climate. Right. And that's a mindset. The COVID, if it's taught me anything, we have to stop being the me generation and we have to start becoming the we.
Amen.
It's thinking about everyone and how your actions are going to affect everyone, not just yourself. And that was the biggest takeaway. I just saw everyone being so narcissistic and whatever they wanted to do. If they wanted to go out and drink and party, it didn't matter that they were doing the hair and makeup on number one on the call sheet. They just did it. Well, that cannot happen. Right. That's not the days are gone in that regards. We need to think about everyone and the compassion and caring of each individual. And I constantly, you know, what I never did is I never put myself in the shoes that I was barking the orders out to.
Right.
And that's the biggest switch for me. It's like, okay, if I'm going to bark these orders out to somebody, how is that going to feel if I'm the recipient of it? Am I going to feel good when I tell them that, you know, I call them out in front of everyone? There's sometimes when you need to do that, but you want to do it in a way that has an inspirational way. And there's one way to downtrodden, but then there's another way to say, guy, I understand you're trying your best, but you got to do better. Like we had a digital utility that showed up 3 days late in a row. And, you know, in a pool of many technicians, that guy would have been kicked to the side. And I just went up to him and I said, here's the deal. I see the passion that you had during our prep. I saw how much you read all the manuals and made all my systems that nobody knows how to work. You made that all happen. So I see that you love what you do. You can't be late. And I'm going to give you one more chance. I've given you three. But what you need to do is you need to come in 30 minutes earlier. Because you know what? I'm here. I'm usually here an hour before the camera trucks even open up. Why? Why am I there? I'm taking my time. I walk through the sets. I'm looking at the sheets. I'm envisioning the light. I'm envisioning the blocking. I'm doing all that. So you come in an hour early. You open up the trucks. You get all the gear ready for everyone. You get my monitors all set up. You get the comm system set up. So when I walk in and the crew walk in, you're handing everyone their comm system, and communication is key. And that dude turned around the next day. So it's like, it's tough love at some points, but also caring and compassion and trying to inspire them by seeing their best attributes and really kind of fueling that and then guiding them in a way that has some kid gloves.
As opposed to calling him out on set or abusing him or yelling at him or, you know, how dare you jump off the condor that's about to go into the ravine.
Exactly.
Like, instead of that way of going about it. I still can't believe that story. I still can't believe that guy yelled at you. Like, are you kidding? I just dumped two stories. Are you kidding me?
Oh, yeah. Exactly.
Now you're doing, and that's, you know what you've said is absolutely right. And, when I direct, I do the exact same thing. I try to be as cool as I can, but sometimes you do need tough love. And sometimes you got to pull somebody aside and give them a good talking to, because attitude is attitude. Ego is ego, especially in this
exactly.
business.
Exactly. And one thing that I've always tried to do, and I think this is the last bit of advice I want to give,
sure.
Is you have to be humble.
Yeah. Amen.
Because arrogance and ego will drive you in ways that are not good. And I always try to be humble. When I walk on set, you know, everyone comes up to me and they're like, oh my God, Shane, you're a legend. You know, I get all this praise, which is awesome. But at the same time, I never let it go to my head. I'm sitting there talking to them about, you know, what they did this weekend. And you know, they're part of my team. It's not me being the hierarchy, even though that's how it's set up. But I treat everyone equally. And I want them, and I want to toss gasoline on anything that they have passion about.
Right.
And trying to kind of flip the switch to them. Even the people that have come off of the oil dike or just come off the construction site, I'm trying to fill them with that filmmaking passion that I had when I came into film school and started to have these aha moments and everything. I'm trying to bring that to them through the Hurlbut Academy and through, you know, just being on set as a cinematographer, as somebody that just wants to continue to educate the future filmmakers of tomorrow.
Shane, I really appreciate you being on the show, man. And it has been a fantastic conversation. I appreciate everything you're doing for the community with your education, as well as just making cool films over the last last year. So I appreciate what you do, my friend. Keep doing what you do. So thanks so much, my friend.
Thank you so much, Alex. It was an absolute pleasure. And I loved your questions, right on the money. This is the kind of stuff that, you know, I want to open up. There's transparency with me. And that's what I think people really respond to as well. Yeah. Like I said, staying humble. I'm not using my ego and arrogance to say, this is who I am and this is what I do. No, I've failed a lot and I've not been a great leader at times. And, you know, I want to, you know, express those and say that I change. And even though that I'm at my 57 years old, I still feel like I'm a 5 year old out there and absolutely love what I do. You know, I've created a long, successful career as a cinematographer, and I want to keep on going.
My friend, I appreciate you. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
I want to thank Shane so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to reach out to Shane, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/498. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and leave a good review on wherever you're listening to this podcast. It really helps us out a lot. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. We are getting close to episode 500, and it's going to be a doozy. So as always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.